This is Jim Zub, the writer of The Avengers, Champions, and Rick and Morty versus Dungeons & Dragons, and you are listening to The Cave of Solitude.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. Once again, I am your host, Eric Anthony, and we have more coverage coming your way from this year's Fan Expo Canada 2018. And for this episode, episode 133, as promised, we have special interviews coming to you from the con floor and Artist Alley, where I got the privilege to chat with three great writers and artists. Namely, Casey Parsons, the cover artist and interior artist of the recently published comic book anthology magazine Cauldron, published by my good friends Ricky Lima, Shane Heron, Sam Noir, who've all been on the show. Check our archives. I had great episodes with those guys, but this time at the con, it was my mission on the first day that I was there to find Casey, who's doing some incredible work. He's getting stuff out there. He was tabling for the first time in a few years, and his stuff is looking phenomenal. I feel he's the type of artist who, if Marvel or DC had a variant cover option, his cover would be on everybody's pull list. That's how good I think his painted work is, and the stuff inside of Cauldron looks phenomenal. So we got a chance to first off chat with Casey Parsons. Great chat with him, followed by, on the Saturday that I was at the con, local superstar, comic superstar, not local superstar, he's a local legend, but comic superstar, Jim Zub, who, if you heard in the intro, you heard all the stuff that he's writing. So I get to chat with him for about 25 minutes. I really appreciate how generous he was with his time. We get into the latest trade that was published, hardcover, beautiful trade, Avengers No Surrender, that he co-wrote with Mark Waid and Al Ewing and a slew of artists that has been getting a lot of critical acclaim if you look at all the reviews for it, which is really, really nice to hear. And I'm looking forward to reading it. I bought a copy myself from Jim at the show. And then we end the show with DC Marvel writer, Aftershock writer, Marguerite Bennett, who is putting out some incredible work herself. The favorite title of hers that I'm currently reading is Animosity. And the reason that I picked up Animosity in the first place was because another friend of the show, Mike Ruth, did some variant covers for the Animosity books, and I loved his covers for it, and I wanted to support Mike. So I bought the trade of Animosity, and turned out that I really, really loved the story. So we talk about it on the show. Definitely go check out all the people that I've mentioned. Go check out the stuff that they're working on. It's quality work. You're going to enjoy it, and I really hope you enjoy these interviews. So before we get into the interviews, don't forget to leave us an email at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. We will read it on the show. We will respond back to you as well. Leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on Facebook and interact with us. We're always happy to interact with anybody who's listening, and we even take requests for different things that you want to hear on the show. So now, without further ado, we're going to get into episode 133, the interviews at Fan Expo Canada with Casey Parsons, Jim Zub, and Marguerite Bennett. Thank you for listening. So we are here at 2018 Fan Expo Canada, and to start off the show with our first interview, we are with the man of the hour, Casey Parsons. Casey, how's it going?
Very good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited for the weekend. So you've had a table before at numerous Fan Expos, but you said you took some time off. What's it like being back and having a table again?
So I did three Fan Expos in a row and then took last year off. Just felt kind of conventioned out. And then, but I feel a lot more ready this time. There's a lot more going on. We're promoting the new Cauldron anthology. I've got a lot of new prints since 2 years ago. I have a couple other published books. So I have Blood Moon, and I got into the latest Toronto Comics anthology as Osgood as Gold. So a lot going on.
So you've been a busy guy.
Busy guy.
And you see the table now, and you got all kinds of stuff to pitch to people. And Cauldron, the cover looks fantastic. The art inside looks great. Can you tell us a little bit about how that project came together?
Thanks very much. Well, Shane Heron, Sam Noir, and Ricky Lima are kind of getting together and wanting to put out their own anthology. And it just, everything was sort of kismet. At the same time, I wanted to do a shorter story and something along the horror genre, and I was thinking of maybe pitching a heavy metal or something along those lines. And I was getting to know these guys, Shane and Sam and them, and it just all worked out. The timing was just perfect, and they thought I'd be great for the project. The cover, I wasn't the first choice necessarily. They were looking around at different artists, trying to get a bigger name on like just to kind of promote the start of the project. And it just happened, like, because of scheduling and stuff, they thought, well, Casey, can you do it? And, you know, they wanted, like, a Frazetta type of cover, because the book is meant to harken back to the old eerie and creepy and heavy metal issues of yore. So they said, you know, Casey, can you do a Frazetta type cover in a couple of days? So I said, yeah, sure. And I did.
And it came out looking great. I heard on another podcast that you did on the Fastball Special that you already got some people who are trying to get the original cover for it. Is that, did I hear correctly?
Yeah, I've had a couple of people interested.
Well, that's it right there.
Original with me, okay, yeah.
That's it right there.
Yep. So I've got the original here on display. So I put the price tag of $800 on it just to see if that'll go. Some people think it should be higher or hang on to it. Or if this book gets picked up and published, then, you know, it might be sought after. But I don't know. I'm still kind of in the starving artist phase. So,
so doing aside from doing art, you also have a comic shop that you co-own?
Yes. Comic One Books in Stony Creek. So I'm a partner with a couple other gentlemen. I've slowly been backing out of the store just because the art's starting to pick up a lot. So I can't really spend the time in the shop anymore. But I'm still trying lining up like guest artists for the store. I still try and promote it kind of peripherally now. But check it out. It's a great shop, Comic One Books in Stony Creek. The only shop around in Stony Creek. The next nearest ones, there's a bunch in Hamilton. But we're all like good friends. So I'm a partner in that shop. But as I say, I've been pulling out to work on more art projects and comic projects now.
Yeah. So you're an artist, a great artist. You own a comic shop. Where does the love for comics come from for you? Can you take us back a little bit where you first fell in love with the genre?
The medium.
Yeah, I mean, I have a huge appreciation and love for the medium. It feels like one of the last artistic avenues you can go down and kind of absolute freedom. But you've got the brilliance of, you've got storytelling and illustration kind of blended together. So, and doing something sequentially and trying to lay out a page and how far you can push the art on a page. It's a little bit different than doing fine art. Like, I'm sort of fine art trained, classically trained. So I'm trying to bridge those gaps between the classical world, traditional art, and the comics medium and what it can do. But I go way back. Like, I was an Incredible Hulk fan when I was like 2 years old.
Oh, wow.
You know,
watching a television show?
Yeah, and I was at my grandparents' house watching it in French, and I didn't care. Hulk was just growling, so I didn't have to translate anything. And I just love that, you know, this big green guy throwing people around. And then I started collecting Hulk stuff from a young age. And I actually got to meet the original owner of Comic One Books when I was a kid. I was climbing out of the stroller under his tables digging for rampaging Hulks.
Oh, wow.
I was like 3 years old, right? And I ended up working for him and becoming good friends, and that was Tom Lang, late Tom Lang. And I ended up working for him in high school, and he kind of opened my eyes to all types of different artists like Paul Pope and Evan Dorkin and Sienkiewicz. And, I've just got a huge appreciation now. And then since reopening the store in 2013 after Tom passed away, started discovering people like Hal Foster, the Canadian creator of Prince Valiant. So he's a big hero, and he influenced guys like Frazetta and Al Williamson and Wally Wood and, you know, Russ Heath, who just passed away, and Gray Morrow and Reed Krant, all these guys. So I go right back to the, you know, who influenced who, and looking at old illustrators like N.C. Wyeth and new illustrators, you know, and still looking at Sienkiewicz and guys like Jason Sean Alexander. So I pull influences from all over the place.
So going back to you being a kid and loving the Incredible Hulk, did you have a favorite Hulk artist or a Hulk cover artist? Because there was the Incredible Hulk regular comic that you find on the newsstand, but then you said something about the Rampaging Hulk.
Yeah.
Was there a difference in style?
Oh, Hulk's been drawn in so many different ways.
Right.
those old Rampaging issues are still some of the best Hulk art you're going to see around, because it's the only time we get like John Buscema drawing. He had Joe Jesko covers. You had Ernie Chan, who was brilliant. He was in the comics and the Rampaging Hulk, and he was phenomenal when he did stuff. He did very little, but when he did work on the Hulk, it was amazing. So those would be like my top guys. Yeah, John Byrne did a little Hulk run. That was good. Yeah. Dale Keown, right? McFarlane. I mean, yeah, Hulk's had a few good artists, and all so different, but all good in their own way.
Right. So being now, you reopened the store. What made you want to reopen a comic shop? Was it just your connection to it as a kid, or did you want to get into the business of selling comics?
Again, it was sort of a timing issue. I was at a point, I had done teaching, and I wanted to kind of, I was looking around at maybe doing like selling art supplies and then maybe teaching classes in a shop. And Tom passed away, and that was a sudden shock, you know, for us. And that was kind of our safe haven, and we loved the store. Like, the local people for Comic One Books loved that shop, so we didn't want to see it disappear, and we just wanted to open the shop. So a few of us got together and were able to reopen it, clean it all up, and kind of bring back the vision and love of comics and the medium, and try and honor Tom and the way he would sell books. And we never got into CGC. Like, he just appreciated and loved the medium, supported creators, especially the underdogs, the indie guys.
Right.
Tom always did his best to support them. So we tried to do the same thing and support the medium and creators and artists then. You know, and it became like a labor of love. It's not something you get into to try and make a ton of money. It's just, you got to love it, right, to do it. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes the store successful is just the fact that, you know, we love the medium and love supporting it. Yeah.
I'm always interested in people who choose to own comic book shops or run a shop, because it is, like you said, a labor of love. And there's a very fine line of being just making it to cover the costs of running a store, because really it's almost like, in a way, they're serving the community to get people these books, because it's a gamble every time you put in an order. So did you learn anything from what people are attracted to or what they lean towards buying, and does it in any way affect how you pursue the art that you do?
That's an interesting question. I might spin it a different way. You're always going to have like your big fans of DC and Marvel, the big two.
Right, yeah.
That's kind of the bread and butter of any comic store, and you can't get around that.
Yeah.
Marvel's been having some trouble lately, but you know, those diehard fans are still coming back for those characters. Like, I'll still look at the Hulk, you know, all these years later. But I think it's on the onus of the store to try and help show your customers other avenues, other possibilities. Like, introduce them to, if you like this, maybe you'll like this. Like an indie comparative. Like, and I love companies like Dark Horse and Image and Aftershock and Valiant's doing amazing stuff lately. It's up to the comic stores to try and introduce these creators to the public, right? I think it's up to us to try and sell that. Because if they're just going to go in and just buy their character and kind of be myopic about their purchases, they're not going to discover these other things where they could be so much happier looking at, say, Exo Manowar instead of Iron Man or something, right?
Have you read that series, Exo Manowar?
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't checked it out anyway, I mean it's just gorgeous. The art's amazing. The stories are top-notch. Like, Valiant's just really kicking butt. And that's the thing. I mean, and there's hits and misses. I mean, Image books, like, and it's always a gamble. Like, comic stores are so bizarre. It's the most wacky business model you could have. And everything is a gamble. You don't really return stuff. So you pull in all this stock, and then you got to try and store it, whatever you don't sell. And you're hoping stuff sells, and you're guessing on, well, how much do you think this title's going to sell, or this new number one that we've never sold before? And it's all guesswork, right? So you take a chance. There's so many things, like, and I try and follow, like, as being on both ends of selling and also trying to produce now. I mean, I follow artists and writers around. So if Jeff Lemire's got a new project, I'm going to try and get that in the shop and try and get my hands on it and try and push that. If I love it, I try and give that love to somebody else, right? And hopefully they'll like it. And if they don't, whatever, I'll try and find something else that they like. I think it's trying to listen to your customers and see what they're into, and then try and find things that suit their interests. I think that's kind of what the store does, right? Yeah.
So now that you're back on the creative side and you've got all these things happening, is there a type of work that you want to get into, or is it just whatever could be, you want to try it? Or are you more into the heavy metal aesthetic that Cauldron is?
I think right now, I don't really have that super urge to be a part of Marvel DC, like to be part of the factory churned out sort of strict regime. I mean, that being said, I'd still love to do stuff for those guys, but I love the freedom of the indie world. Like, I would love to be with a company like Dark Horse or Image and just doing creator-own stuff. I mean, I'm looking to hopefully do a graphic novel in the next couple of years.
Does it have a name?
Not yet.
Okay, you can't tell us yet. Okay, I got it.
I don't want to say too much yet. I've been planning something for a while. But doing stuff like Cauldron has been, it's been a wonderful experience. Like, it's sort of getting my, you know, artistic chops in a sense. Like, it's given me freedom to explore and figure out, okay, how do I put these pages together? I've got deadlines and stuff, but I had creative freedom.
Right.
So it's been wonderful. Like, working with horror is just so much fun. But I'd like to tackle all sorts of things. I'm kind of a jack of all trades in a way, and that may be a downfall. I don't know. But I'm trying to just try a lot of stuff and see, you know, see what I end up liking. I think it's just, I try and approach things, like drawing is drawing to me. Like, I feel like I should be able to draw anything and just love the process of drawing and illustrating, and just see what I can do with that. So I'm trying different mediums and with these prints and stuff like that. So I'm mixing a lot of things together. And I just want to see what I'm capable of, really. So it's still early, but I feel good. Like, Cauldron, I was really proud of. I think it turned out really well. And I'm very happy to have been a part of it. And just, it looks great. So I'm hoping to do more things like that.
I think you guys are onto something, because it, like you were saying, the creative freedom of it. And I think it'll, you know, Shane, Ricky, Sam, yourself, have a lot of friends in the industry that they'd be able to express themselves in a book like that so much more than some of the things they're hired to do. And it looks great, like you said. Like, everyone will be happy to work together.
That's the difference, right? I mean, with indie projects, that's where you get the passion. You got artists and writers who have an idea of their own, and they're passionate about it. They have something they want to share with you. Instead of, like, being told, okay, you got to draw this way or write this way.
And you can't do that to that guy because he's got to show up here.
Yeah, and they're given restrictions, where in the indie world, you're given this freedom. It's like, hey, you know, you can tell this story now, like, in the way you want to tell it. And, you know, no Comics Code authority on your back. You know, so Cauldron, it's just mature readers, and it's... But it's fun, right? It's like, we're hoping that maybe 15-year-old kid will want to hide it from his mom and take it home, right? Like, we want that feeling back, like that. Hopefully the passion of creating it has come across to the reader. Like, I think they can see that we loved making this thing, and we wanted to share this, and hopefully the reader feels that love and that passion, right, coming across.
Yeah. So you had meant, I know we're jumping all over the place, but you said that you were a teacher?
Yeah.
What did you teach?
Kind of everything. I was hoping to teach art. So I did teacher's college, and I went right from teacher's college over to England for about a year.
Okay.
And I was teaching everything. I was hoping to just teach art classes. I worked at a middle school, and I had about 200 plus students every week. And I was teaching, like, religion and history and everything. So
that's awesome.
There was things I wasn't expecting, and then I ended up moving right into London and doing supply work around high schools and stuff. So, I mean, I enjoy teaching math and English, whatever, and I was hoping to get English or art and teach art. And that didn't happen, but I ended up kind of going back and forth and teaching some, did private schools here with Blythe Academy in Yorkville and in Burlington as well. And then I ended up going back to England for about half a year with a friend, and came back and did a little more teaching, and then was sort of getting out of it. I wasn't able to produce art, and I wasn't able to, again, the freedom wasn't there. Like, there's a lot of boundaries with teaching, and I wasn't able to teach art the way I kind of wanted to teach it. Like, I may go back to that. Like, I'd like to do sort of private stuff. Like, and just teach. I was taught in a very traditional way, and I would like to, I just feel it's up to an artist, like, if they're given something like that, to try and share it to the next generation. So I kind of have that belief, like, share what you know, and help other people get to where you are so they can add their voice to.
You still want the teaching process to have the creative juices flowing as opposed to being held back.
Yeah, and I don't mind if anyone ever wants to ask me, like, how do you do what you're doing? Or because I'm still learning stuff too, but I'm happy to share. Like, I've learned some interesting things just by trying a lot of stuff. So I've tried just about everything. Yeah, I mean, if anyone ever wants to ask me, or like, I'm happy to share knowledge or draw with people and, you know, share what I know.
And speaking of school, you went to school with a couple of well-known guys yourself, right? Yes. Who are some of the people you went to school with?
Oh, I had a wonderful class. So I went to Sheridan. I'm going to age myself, but I went in 97 to 2000. So I had a wonderful class. By the time we were in third year, you kind of get mixed up with people who are ahead of you and behind you. And it was kind of, I had Chip Zdarsky in my class, Mike Ruth. There was like Sarah Morris, Josh Deck, Eric Kim, another guy in comics. There's so many great people in the class. There's Andrew Zibley. I mean, I had a wonderful, very talented group. Lovely group, yeah. And it's been nice. Like, Dan Solberg, who's here as well, like, he was around. Yeah, it was great. And now, like, getting into comics again, I've been reunited with, like, half of my old Sheridan class, which has been great. Yeah. And then I did Mac. I did visual arts at Mac, and then Western, you know, Teachers College. So
that's pretty crazy when you it's like a draft year almost, when you see like people come up through a certain level of college and then they all get drafted into their league. But like, to have Chip Zdarsky, Mike Ruth, all guys that are top-notch talents, and you're a part of it too. And you're looking at your stuff, it belongs on the cover of major books. Like, it's great stuff.
I mean, Sheridan was the place to go. I think you can see the training coming out there. Like, some aspects of Sheridan I try and get out of my system. And other things I've tried to hold on to, it was no nonsense there. And Kagan McLeod was another guy who was around too. Like, so yeah, it was an amazing, amazing time. Yeah, it's totally changed now.
Yeah.
But
now you guys are all here.
Now we're all here. Yeah.
So last question, if you had to recommend one book as a comic book fan and as a comic book shop owner, a run for people to read, what would you recommend to them?
Oh,
I know you said Exo Man of War, which is a great pick, but is there something that's like your personal favorite that you think everyone should read?
Yeah, I like Push and Valiant as a company, even just their company model is something to admire. Wow, that's a tough question. I've been enjoying, just trying to think about the books I'm reading right now.
It could even be something that you read years ago. If that makes it harder or easier, I don't know.
Right now I'm enjoying like Gideon Falls. I think Jeff Lemire is doing an amazing job writing that, and Sorrentino's art is just like, they've upped their game, and that's been a fun read. So the first arc just finished, but that was a good book. If you haven't read Gideon Falls, that's a great one. Yeah.
And Jeff Lemire is here this weekend.
Yeah, I believe he's here. Yeah. I've met him a few times. I've met his mom. Yeah, he's
really?
A really nice guy. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I want to try to get him on the podcast. That would be amazing, but I don't know if he does podcasts with just anybody.
I don't know. I feel like he's super nice. He's a little bit shy, I think. But
yeah.
And he just talked about releasing a new project with Mike Diodato.
Wow.
Yeah, so like, they've been working secretly on this graphic novel or something for a while.
They did, I think, 6 issues of Thanos together.
Yeah. Yeah, so they've worked together. You know, Lemire did Old Man Logan. I think Diodato was doing some of the covers for that as well. Yeah. Yeah, I love his stuff. Yeah. Like, I just finished Royal City and things like that. I love when he's doing his independent stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's so diverse, like, even with something like Black Hammer. And then he does the book that it was like, looked like a novel. I forgot what it was. Roughneck.
Roughneck was great. Sweet Tooth. One of my favorites, too, he did was Underwater Welder, because it felt like an old Twilight Zone story.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know, we're pitching Jeff Lemire here a lot.
That's okay, but hey, he's a good guy. It's worth pitching the good guys.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for giving us your time. I hope the weekend is fantastic, and you sell all these prints, and that I don't know if I want the cover of Cauldron to go yet, because I think it can go for more. So, but if it does go, that's great.
I'm willing to accept more for the cover.
take the price off and see what people offer for. Just say on sale. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Okay, everybody, we are here on Saturday, the big day at the Toronto Comic Con. This is Fan Expo Canada 2018, and I have the privilege to be sitting here with comic superstar and local legend, Mr. Jim Zub, the writer of The Avengers. His wife is here laughing, but it's true. Is it not?
That sounds very odd, but yes, yeah, sure. I have no idea. 8-year-old me is still wondering how this all happened. So yeah, it's kind of great, honestly.
When your name is on the latest Avengers trade hardcover beside Mark Waid, Al Ewing, and people are praising it,
yeah,
that says something.
Thank you. I'm really, really proud of the book. I'm thrilled that how well it came together. And yeah, it was a real special project to be a part of. So it feels like a milestone in a lot of ways. But there's still that other side of you where it's really surreal.
Right.
Even though you did it, even though you did the work, it's there sitting in front of you and go, how did this happen? You know, it's been cool.
You're still a fan, obviously, yeah. Right? That's the passion is still there, which is good. So the question we always ask people is, how did you fall in love with the medium of comic books?
So I grew up, obviously, like reading comics. The first comics I really collected were Marvel books. So I got in the door with there was an old magazine when I was a kid called The Electric Company, and they would have little Spidey Super Stories, and I liked those, but I didn't really collect them. I just sort of read them at the library. The first books I started collecting were the old G.I. Joe books. So
the Larry Hama.
Oh, yeah. I love those books. They were crazy. And through those, you know, through all the ads in the back and stuff, I would see all the Spider-Man and Fantastic Four and all that, and I got kind of obsessed with that. My brother and I started collecting Marvel. We sort of split the Marvel Universe in half. Like, he would get all the X-Men and eventually all the mutant books, like X-Factor and all that. I would get all the Spider-Man stuff, Thor and Hulk and Fantastic Four. He really loved Doctor Strange, and then so did I. And then we'd buy old Conan issues and just really loved everything that Marvel was putting out. And when the official Handbook of the Marvel Universe came out, we just started obsessing over it, like reading it and rereading it and memorizing parts of it. And it just like felt like this vibrant, dynamic world of really cool stuff all the time. And so that's still part of me, you know, when I'm working on these books or when I'm creating something new for the Marvel Universe, there's that little voice in the back of my head that can't believe it, because that's the stuff that I really loved, you know, was those new stories, those new ideas, those new things kind of organically popping up in the stories. Yeah.
So was there a particular, you mentioned a list of books that you liked. Was there a particular one that left that indelible mark on you?
I mean, once I sort of transitioned from just reading characters and I started to reread stories to certain artists or certain writers started to jump out at me. So even though my brother was collecting X-Men, I started to get really obsessed with the Paul Smith issues, the Claremont ones. There's like a two-part or three-parter with Wolverine's wedding in Japan, and I was just like blown away by it. There's an Avengers Annual 10 that's Michael Golden drew it. It's the first appearance of Rogue.
Right.
And that one just blew my mind. Like every page of that book is like tattooed in my brain. Like I can't get enough of it. That G.I. Joe 21, the silent interlude one.
I always hear about that
book.
It's
phenomenal. It's such good storytelling. It's such clean, solid, emotional storytelling. I love that issue. Trying to think of other stuff. I love the Hobgoblin's introduction with John Romita Jr. stuff in Amazing Spider-Man was a real formative one for me. The two annuals where the X-Men and the New Mutants go to Asgard, so it's like a fantasy take on all the mutant characters.
Arthur Adams blew my
mind. Like I could not, lost my mind for those books. They were so, I reread them and reread those issues to death. Like the staples falling out and the covers unhinged, not because I treated them badly, just because you read it, I just vaporized it. You read it so.
But those books weren't meant to last or to be encased, right?
It wasn't about keeping the mint. It was about enjoying the story.
Exactly.
And they didn't collect this stuff. I mean, they eventually made a trade paperback of the Asgardian one, but at the time there were very few trade paperbacks. So all you had were those issues, and that made them that much more precious.
Just so you know, if anyone comes to your table and you need to talk to them, go for it.
No worries.
So now becoming a writer yourself, was the dream to become a comic book writer? Because I know you were a big Dungeons & Dragons fan, so that makes you be you know, naturally exercise the creative muscles all the time. So how did you, in regards to writing or art, because I know you're an artist as well, how did you get into that?
So I started originally, I didn't think comics was a possibility, not because I didn't want to do it. It just seemed, the publishing industry in the 80s and the early 90s was, it's, you know, centered in New York City, or you had to be, I mean, there were, I knew there were Canadians that worked on this stuff, but I didn't feel like I had access to do it. It just didn't seem to make, but I got into animation because I love animation, and also I figured I could be one of a couple hundred credits rolling up a screen way easier than one of four people working on a comic, you know? So I got into animation, worked in Canadian animation for a few years, and then when the industry sort of shifted from traditional hand-drawn animation to computer, I was going to go back to school to get some retraining. And one of my friends was working at a new studio called Udon, and so for the summer, I was supposed to, you know, color some comics and make a little bit of extra money before I went back to school. And instead, I stayed at Udon for 8 years and learned all under the hood, like how publishing works, project management, pre-press, art direction, comic storytelling, like really got this on-the-spot education and how all this stuff worked. And it really changed the way I looked at the business and understood the pipeline. And so when I started making my own comics, I had all that knowledge running underneath because I had colored comics, I had drawn some stuff, I had lettered, I had edited and helped out with every part of production. So once I started making my own stuff, it was that much easier to know what was working. So 2009, I did a story in one of the Pop Gun anthologies for Image, and Eric Larson, who was the publisher at Image at the time, really liked it. So he said, if you guys want to pitch this as a comic series, you know, I'd be interested. So the original artist and I, Chris Stevens, put it together. Chris dropped off the project, and eventually Edwin Hong got on board. And then we did Skull Kickers. That's 2010. And then it just sort of took off from there. I started to get, people really liked it, started to get offers to do other writing projects. A lot of it's sword and sorcery, because that's what Skull Kickers was. But slowly but surely building a reputation as someone who was, you know, good at this and reliable and passionate about what I'm doing. So eventually getting, you know, my hooks in at IDW and DC and then eventually Marvel. So, yeah.
Awesome. So you're also a teacher as well.
Right. So I still teach up at Seneca, and I help coordinate the animation program there. So I've got that animation background, and I usually teach in any particular term. I'm teaching two or three classes, usually layout and design, which is like perspective drawing, and animation history. So it's like film analysis, storytelling, composition, stuff like that.
It was really sweet yesterday when I came by your table to get a copy of No Surrender. You had a student there, and she was just standing back. And I, are you guys ahead of me? You can go. We know him. He's my teacher. She was so starstruck. My teacher's famous. What's that like for you to get that reaction from your student?
It's a real joy. Honestly, teaching is phenomenal. Like, I absolutely love interacting with the students. And every new group that comes through, they're so vibrant and energetic and pumped about art and creativity. And it, like, refills my batteries. Like, it reminds me about that joy. It's not like I don't have joy for this stuff, but they're so, how do I put it? Like, this is all brand new to them, and they're on the cusp of doing this as a career, and they want it so badly, and they work so hard at it, and it's like, it makes sure I don't take it for granted. Like, this is special. This is awesome. And if they energize me, and you know, I energize them, and it just becomes this nice kind of loop of excitement and enthusiasm. And then I've been teaching now for over 12 years. That's 12 years worth of graduates. So whenever you do a convention like this, you'll see generations of students coming around. And they're, you know, they're getting older. Some of them are getting married, and they've got kids. They bring their babies by, and I get to meet them, or they tell me about the jobs they're working on, or, you know, some of them have gone on to work in comics, like Jorge Molina.
Yeah,
the artist on X-Men Blue. Like, I taught that guy perspective drawing. You know, it's sort of mind-blowing to me now how far he's come and the amazing stuff that he's doing. But other students as well, working on all kinds of different productions for Disney or Ubisoft or Pixar or Blizzard, all these different companies that the students have gone off to have these amazing careers at, and that I had just a tiny little bit of influence on that, is it's really gratifying.
I don't think, as far as, you know, having, all of us are former students, but that good teacher, you never forget right. that teacher. That it's more of an impact than you may think. You think it's a little bit, but sure. it's huge. So when you know you get to see them come back that's around and be successful, that's yeah. that energy of exchange is what life's all about, really.
No, and that idea of one of the things you try and do is instill in them not just specific. I mean, there's obviously theory and there's lessons and everything else, but it's also general work practices and attitudes and professionalism and communication, right? And so when they're doing well and they feel that they have done, that they're ready for what the industry is going to, you know, throw their way. And not just about here's how it works when everything's going well, but here's how to roll with the punches when things don't go well. You know what I mean? That not every project, in fact, almost every project is going to have challenges that you never anticipated. And almost no plan survives the battle, you know, right. and you have to learn how to adapt. You know, when I'm teaching, last semester where I was teaching and the power went out, like, well, how are we going to work on these computers and stuff? Well, we're not. Okay, we're going to go over to the big marker board and we're just going to do, you know, hand-drawn stuff on there. Or whatever, the lights are off, we'll go outside, grab your sketchbook, we're going to go out to a field and we're going to do a lecture. And they're laughing, but it's sort of like, we don't have to stop. You can, there's always a way, we'll figure this thing out. And if I freaked out, if I was like, well, we can't do the class today and threw my hands up, it's sort of like, yeah, it's not always going to be perfect. Let's roll with it. And
it almost teaches like a defeatist attitude. Like, if this isn't working, we can't continue.
Right, right. Yeah, sure, it's not ideal. I would prefer we had power right now.
Sure.
But in real life, things go wrong. What do you do about it? Do you freak out or do you look for solutions? You know what I mean? So it's just stuff like that. It's just, it's both theory and in the classroom kind of lessons. And then it's also general, here's what it's like to be in the business. Here's what it's like to, you know, you guys are coming in first thing in the morning and you're all bleary-eyed and bloodshot-eyed because you've been working all night. I'm coming in bleary-eyed because I was working on a script or I just got back from a convention. We're in the same boat. Yeah, there's years that separate us, but you're going to be a working professional and you can do this, you know? Yeah.
That's pretty amazing for you to be able to manage your time with a full-time job that like that. And this in itself is a full-time job too.
Yeah,
so.
It is. It is like two full-time jobs, but I love both of them, and I love being able to, they kind of feed off each other well, so.
That's good. So you do a lot of independent work, create your own stuff, Wayward, Skull Kickers we see here, but then you're also working on something from Marvel.
Right.
What do you enjoy, not what you enjoy more, but what's the experience like of, do you feel that your creative freedom can sometimes be stifling because you can go anywhere, but then having, you know, limitations can also spark creativity? How's that work for you?
I like doing both because they flex different creative muscles.
Right.
Like, as much as people say, oh, doesn't it suck to have an editor tell you what to do? You're like, they don't. First of all, they don't. Second of all, having limitations, having set parameters forces you to solve problems differently. Having the creator-owned books is amazing because it's an open field and we can kind of do what we want. But it also means you have to create your own structure. And Marvel has a structure. It has a sandbox. It has the Marvel Universe. It has editors. It has groups, you know, the Avengers group and the Spider-Man group and the Cosmic group. And these are all these little fiefdoms in the kingdom of Marvel that are being run by those editorial groups. And they have different ways of working. So if I'm working for Jordan White in the X-Men office doing Mystery and Madripoor, he likes things in a particular format. And he interacts with the writers and the artists differently than Tom Brevoort in the Avengers office. And it's neither one is better, they're just different. And it's different working processes and getting used to them and then hitting your marks and making sure that you know what you're there to do and do it well, you know? And I'm still me, I've got my voice and the way I want to do a project, but adapting a little bit to the way that their needs as well, you know? And that's a challenge in a good way. And then on the creator-owned books, I can really cut loose and go, you know what? No limits. We can go berserk on this thing. We can do some really crazy stuff. And having both of those sort of chugging at the same time is really gratifying.
Right. Yeah. So in regards to Avengers, you grew up a big comic fan. Do you have a favorite Avengers run or something that is, you know, your go-to Avengers?
There's a storyline. I don't know that it's like unbelievably famous, but there was a series of issues. John Buscema drew them, and it's Baron Zemo and the Masters of Evil 4 basically take over the Avengers Mansion.
Under Siege, yeah.
Under Siege.
That's ranked number one on most lists.
Oh,
that's the
God.
Number one Avengers story.
I love that thing. I read that in single issues on a monthly basis.
Wow.
And so every month was just like a shock to the system because they took over the mansion. Oh, my God, they've like Thor's in the hospital. Oh, my God, Jarvis is unconscious. And you didn't know it was going to work out okay. Not just because I was a kid, but it was so visceral and it was so powerful. And I was like, man, this book is the best. And they put the team in such a pressure cooker and then paid it off in a way that was so satisfying. And so I felt this like really good pressure. Like we need to, on No Surrender, we got to like go for broke. We got to surprise people. We got to blow it out, blow up the mansion, blow it out, do crazy things. Have combat and situations that people, they don't know how it's all going to turn out. They can make assumptions, but the reality is going to be hopefully something they never saw coming. But then the minute they read it, they go, oh, that's the way it had to turn out. You know, that's your hope with these kinds of stories.
Right. So in regards to the current Avengers universe,
yeah.
There are so many different books, so many different teams. It's kind of hard to know where to jump in and what to read.
Sure.
So when you guys do a weekly like this, how do you manage the creative? Because you got three writers
yep.
passing the book back and forth. So how does that work for you guys to put this together and for it to work well?
We met really early on. So No Surrender actually started, believe it or not, December 2016. So over a year before release. Tom has said, look, we're going to combine all the Avengers books into a weekly. We want to stream it up to the release of Infinity War. Are you guys interested? You know? But, I mean, you know, everyone responds in a couple minutes. Yes, great. Sounds fun. Let's do it. So we started emailing back and forth really casually over the holidays. Christmas, you know, you just jump on an email. Hey, throwing a bunch of big sort of broad brainstorming out there, but nothing really set. And then we... first week of February, we all flew into New York and we did a day in the office at Marvel and we did a story breakdown. So we all sat down and for about 9 hours, we literally just did story structure. So we had some broad ideas in terms of big picture. We wanted to use a lot of the non-A-list Avengers. We wanted to bring some people out from the past. We wanted to surprise, you know, have some weird twists and turns, but we didn't know what the story was really. In that room with note cards and Sharpies, we're writing ideas, we're discarding ideas, we're putting them back in play, and we're just structuring this thing out. First in terms of big, broad beats. So it was part of an initiative called Marvel Legacy. So what started to become clear was that was actually the theme. It was all about legacy. So the legacy of Lightning, for example, who was an Avenger but never really feel like he got his due. Or maybe he wasted his, you know, chance. So that's a legacy he's trying to change. Or something like the Grandmaster, who has a legacy that's actually built on someone else's identity, but you don't know that until we reveal it. Or someone like Voyager, who's inserted herself into the legacy of the Avengers, you know, as a traitor, but the Avengers don't know that. Or, you know, all the idea of the Hulk's legacy, he thinks that these events that where he's died and come back are unrelated, but it's actually this legacy of the Immortal Hulk that Al came up with. So all these different permutations on the idea of historical legacy and superheroic legacy. And that informed all the big arcing stories. Then breaking each one down in terms of our team members, what they all wanted, what they were going to get by the end of it, what changes were going to happen to characters, and what dramatic payoffs we were going to have. What ones we could seed earlier in our individual series before the weekly, and what ones we're going to feed out of it. So it was a real, it sounds very cold and mechanical, but it's like an emotional thing where we're all throwing big ideas into the table and laughing. And literally within those 8 or 9 hours, we're making in-jokes, and a camaraderie builds up between all of you. You all want the same thing. You want to make something great, you know? And so we got back after that, and both Mark and Al had more books than I did. So they were like, Al was doing US Avengers, but he was also doing, crap, I can't remember what other book he was doing.
Uncanny?
Oh, no, he was doing Ultimates.
Okay.
Right? And then I was doing just the Uncanny Avengers.
Right.
Mark was doing like he was already planning his Doctor Strange stuff. He was doing Captain America, and he was wrapping up Champions. And so I was like, okay, and I hadn't taken over Champs yet. And so I was the person with the least amount of stuff on my plate, so I said, I'll do structure breakdown. So I'd go, in this chapter, these events happen. Here's the cliffhanger. Is everyone happy with it? Okay, here's, we'll break it down scene by scene. Mark, you're going to write this. I'll write that. Al, you write this. And then the early part of the story, when the three teams are still kind of separated, it's straightforward. Al's going to write the U.S. Avengers because he's writing U.S. Avengers. Mark's going to write the flagship book, and I'll write Uncanny because that's what I was doing. So, but once the teams, what we wanted to do was mix all the teams together. That's when it got really interesting because it was sort of like we all started to get attached to certain plot lines. And so I was writing like the stuff with Rogue when they went down to the Antarctic, or Mark was writing the Nadia stuff with the Beast in the hospital, or Al was writing a lot of the stuff that was happening back at the base. And so we just sort of found plot lines that we kind of attached to and then would carry it through to the end of the story. But there were three art teams that were working on the book simultaneously. So once we got issue 7 written, we started to, Pepe Larraz starts drawing issue 1, while Kim Jacinto is drawing issue 5, while Paco Medina is drawing issue 9, all at the same time, with the gap in between each one. So with each person, let's say Paco draws a location first in issue 9, but it hasn't, no one's drawn it in the earlier issues, that becomes the master design. And so we had to have this reference folders, we had a spreadsheet with 26 Avengers on it, where are they in the story, make sure we're tracking their plot. Oh, Quicksilver's injured here, make sure he's injured in every issue. Oh, this guy's unconscious. Oh, this person is, you know, in this location. And there were, every so often, that's how we'd catch continuity mistakes. Because you got these two teams, you got the Black Order and you got the Lethal Legion. Which members are in which places? What's everyone doing? Oh, this guy, Living Lightning, can literally turn into lightning, so he can jump between locations, but we got to show that, you know? Like, so it became this like weird, crazy problem solving, but also really fun. Because when you would figure it out, like the puzzle fit together, you went, holy crap, we're doing it. You know, it's a really fun ride. And it was a real joy to do. So we would hand in a script every 2 weeks. And then we'd do proofing on it, and then it would get into the pipeline with all three art teams. So it was nuts. We finished writing No Surrender the week after New York Comic Con. Technically, on the original schedule, it was due the week of New York Comic Con. But Tom built in a deep buffer as well. So we asked for an extra week because it was New York and we were all exhausted.
Sure.
So we wrote the epilogue right after New York. And then the first issue came out second week of January. And it was a weird feeling because everyone was getting super excited and we were done. Like we were just hanging back and doing letter proofing. The work was already finished and people were like, how's it feel? And I was like, what, to write the Avengers? I mean, I did that. That was actually 9 months ago I was freaking out. Now I'm fine. I hope you like it. That was essentially my, you know, it was a wild ride. We had a lot of fun, you know, and the last issue came out, we just had this real surge of adrenaline and, you know, congratulations get sent around and it was fun. It was, like I said, a real milestone in terms of my career and feeling like I was part of something and contributing on a level that I hadn't been able to do before.
Yeah, it's now part of like the pantheon of big Avenger stories that even when you read about it online, like this, everything that they did right, why this works, why this is a callback to classic Avengers. And when you hear all of the cogs in the machine, how you guys have to put it, it's not just write a story, make it work. There's a lot of factors involved. So I'm really excited to read it.
Thanks, man.
So just to close off, what do you have coming up next for people to look forward to?
So I just finished the Hunt for Wolverine Mystery and Madripoor miniseries. That'll be coming in trade, I think, end of the year. I write Champions every month. So I picked up Champions after issue 18. So from 19 onwards, it's been like Sean Isaac and Kevin LaBranda and I doing a real classic kind of teen superhero book. We got some really exciting stuff coming in the fall. The team is going to Weird World, so it's going to go all sword and sorcery. So that
right
Asgard, that Asgard story I told you about where the X-Men get turned into fantasy characters, this is like my, it's not an homage, I'm not directly doing that plot line, but that feeling, that
right.
excitement, that sword and sorcery superhero thing, I'm paying it off, you know, and it, paying it forward, and this is what I love about superheroics, and so I hope people enjoy it, even an iota as much as I did those original stories, you know? Yeah.
that's great. I'm sure everyone's looking forward to it, because every time people talk about Jim's Up books, it's always high praise for them. And on top of it, I've listened to you on other podcasts, seen panels that you were in, and you're one of the nicer guys as well. So that's on to top it off.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Like, we couldn't do this stuff without the strong readership and without that support. So thank you.
No problem. Thank you for your time. I hope the rest of the show goes really, really well for you.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Yeah. So we now have the privilege of talking with DC creator, Animosity writer, Batwoman writer. What else did you have under your belt?
Oh, goodness. Well, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be taking over Power Rangers from Boom Studios. Yeah, so that's the next big one.
We are with none other than Margaret Bennett. Thank you so much for being on the show. How's the show going so far for you?
Oh, I mean, like, Fan Expo has been really, really lovely. And, you know, I can't say that about all the shows, but everyone here has been so sweet, and I would absolutely love to come back.
Is it the Canadian manners that everyone talks about? Is it true? I guess because I grew up here, I don't really know it, but are Canadians more polite?
It may be. It's just been a wonderful community and just a great group of people, I really think.
Awesome. So I want to get a little backstory for you. What got you into comics, if anything did at all? What was your earliest memories of it?
Actually, my gateway drug was Batman the Animated Series, and so I fell in love with the characters before I fell in love with the medium. You know, it was seeing this very, like, dark noir show that was so different than so much of the hyper-sanitized, hyper-saturated media that's given to children, and especially to little girls. And then after that, you know, my love of the characters compelled me to, like, you know, go hunt them down wherever I could. And so that usually meant the comics. And so I was scrounging around from, like, my brother's friends and from my older cousins, like, trying to get, you know, this issue or that issue. And they were rarely ever sequential. So I had to come up on my own what I thought had happened between books, which actually, you know, wound up sort of training me early on, you know, to first of all, like, work on a licensed piece of property and to come up with, you know, original stories based on someone else's mythology.
So did you have a particular episode that stood out for you, or the one that, like, captured you? Like, that's the one. I love this thing.
There were a bunch of episodes that I adored, but specifically it was very character-driven. Like, I loved Harley, I loved Ivy, and I loved Catwoman. And, like, so those, that was my triumvirate. You know, like, what I was talking about with the hyper-saturated, hyper-sanitized media and what we give to girls in particular, so many of the female characters that, you know, you're offered when you're young are these very aspirational characters, you know, these princesses, these gentle maidens, you know, escaping from witches. And it was this thing where they were all so good and perfect and beautiful and kind and sweet but brave, but they could sword fight, but they, you know, were, like, had birds braiding their hair. And it was just the kind of thing that you could never live up to, this just ideal standard. And what I loved about, you know, about the Gotham City Sirens was that they didn't have to be good. They didn't have to be aspirational. They just got to be themselves. And so they were the ones who led me and Mary Chase all the way 20 years on into comics.
So did you become more popular with a certain group of friends, or did it outcast you because you like Batman instead of the things like the hyper-sanitized stuff that you're technically supposed to like, right?
No, I mean, it was really like the adults, you know, who had been pushing, like, oh, you want it, you know, very protected and innocent and clean, you know, what you give your girl children. But, you know, once I was in school and around, you know, other nerdy and geeky friends, you know, that was just par for the course, you know, writing X-Men fan fiction in my notebook between classes.
So now you do DC Bombshells, because I read up that you had a real affinity for the art that you saw for the promotion of it. So what was it that you wanted to capture with the Bombshell line?
Oh, I mean, I adored the idealism, but, you know, also, like, the individuality of each character. Each one was so iconic. You know, with the redesigns, it's this idea that there's something so inherent and so striking about each character that no matter what world or what time you throw them into, their personality shines through. And so it becomes, in remaking their histories, you know, what were the events that defined them, and who did they become once those events are altered? And, you know, so I just really had a wonderful time retro-engineering from Aunt Lucia and Jim Fletcher's, you know, phenomenal artwork to recreate, you know, a unique history for each heroine, and then, you know, how their personalities would develop based on, the, you know, that adapted history, and then how those personalities would interact once, you know, their stories begin syncing up as they're thrown into this, you know, alternate history World War II crisis.
Do you have a favorite character amongst the bombshells that you, a voice that you just love getting into?
I mean, I adore Batwoman, and I'm terribly biased. And, like, you know, in the time that I was working on Bombshells and Batwoman simultaneously, like, my cup was running over with Kate Kane. Unexpectedly, I fell in love with Zatanna while I was working on Bombshells. She, you know, I liked her, but I didn't feel any particular connection to her. But in the writing, I adore Zatanna.
When you take a character like Zatanna, who obviously is, you know, a magician, and her spells are always just, like, speaking backwards, but when you dig into a character like that, do you do, like, a little bit of backstory research into the arts, as it were?
You know, well, for each one, like, there is a lot of research, and, you know, one of the things with Zatanna's form of magic was I didn't want to shy away from it. Like, I kind of have no patience for comic books that are ashamed of being comic books. And, you know, I know that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, and, you know, the people who created her and the people who lent their voices to her narrative and her story, you know, contributed wonderful things. And, you know, with the speaking backwards, I know some folk have, like, shied away from it, or they think it's cheesy or cornball, but I love it. I want to lean in.
So you said that you had the Batman animated series was your gateway drug, and then you started to read the comics. Did you have a series or a Batman story or any series at all that was the one that you just hooked into?
The one that I want to write.
can you say what it is?
Cannot.
You cannot say. So it's in the works.
Not yet, but that is ideally, like, you know, one day. Like, that's still on my bucket list.
Okay. So in regards to Batwoman, Catherine Kane, what is it about that character that appeals to you so much? Because Greg Rucka is, I think, the one who created her, and his initial run on her series is so amazing. The artwork's amazing, the storytelling, the characterization. What is it for you about Catherine Kane?
I mean, it was the same thing as, you know, like with Harley, Ivy, and Selina, where it was the fact that she wasn't aspirational, is that she got to be human. She had trauma, and she got to own it. It wasn't the kind of thing where you throw in a sad, brutalized backstory, you know, like, oh, like, she's wounded, that's why she's strong. It was that Kate Kane was always going to become Batwoman, is that Kate Kane had, like, made this choice, and that she has this sense of conviction. She has this sense of drive and determination that almost borders on being savage, of how strongly she believes in her place in the world. And I really liked, you know, like, that she was screwed up and that she got to own it, that she, you know, she wasn't afraid of her damage. It didn't make her weak. It didn't make her unstable. And that she was flawed. She felt human. She felt human.
And there's a certain integrity to her because of it, because she was always wanting to be of some sort of service and live up to a ideal, but when something about her wasn't good enough for people, she said, this is who I am. And there's that integrity about her that, I mean, everyone can relate to that, or should. I'd like to talk a little bit about your Aftershock work, because I'm a big fan of it. I just read the first two volumes of Animosity. Where did that concept for the animals becoming aware come from?
Honestly, like, my mother's a saint, and, like, growing up, you know, my mama took care of all these messed up, like, you know, SPCA, like, homeless dogs. And so it was this idea, you know, she would go to the shelters and ask, like, their unadoptable dog, like, what's the one that's so messed up that people brought it back? And she would work with them. You know, some of them had been abused. Some of them needed hospice care. They had medical bills. And so there was this very strong idea of dogs and parenthood that was wrapped up in my head. And so, you know, it's sort of like the childlike fantasy of, you know, well, what if your dog could talk? But then as I got older, it became sort of an apocalypse story of, like, what if all dogs could talk? What if all animals could talk? It's a joke that goes too far. Because, like, the major thing is, while it is, you know, like a talking animal story on the surface, you know, begins with, you know, Jesse's the mom and Sandor's the puppy dog, and, you know, she takes care of him and, like, he's the baby. And then when he, you know, when the wake happens, the animals become aware, and Sandor, the bloodhound, sort of comes online. You know, he's 4 or 5 years through his lifespan, and he's a pureblood bloodhound, and they don't live very long. And so when he comes online, he's an adult, and now she's the child. And so it's sort of this idea that, you know, your parents have you, and that, you know, and they take care of you, and then you grow and change. And if you're both lucky enough and live long enough, then your parents enter a second childhood. And now you're the parent to your parents, and in addition to your own children. And so it was that idea of that reversal of the power, of the responsibility, of that we've been the custodians of this world, and now we aren't. And so what happens when the others are in charge and take care of us?
Yeah, I absolutely love Sandor and Jesse's relationship because I have a dog. I'm a big dog person. But I always think to myself, like, what could they be thinking? And as much as we're their caretakers, they do so much for us inside that it's almost like I almost need you more than you would need me, because out in the wild, you'd figure it out. You'd be okay. But it's this love that we have for them. It's this exchange. How did you come up with the different animals that would be part of their group as they were on their little road trip? How did you decide which ones to pick from?
Oh, goodness. I mean, like, that was sort of all over. And it's, you know, one of those things that almost feels so long ago in the deciding that I don't have a quick, pithy answer. But, you know, I sat down and, you know, it was just sort of, they just sort of emerged as it was going. Like, there was no plan for who was going to join up with them. So they, you know, each of them sort of emerged organically. You know, it wasn't really sitting down with an Excel sheet deciding, like, okay, so I need one of these and one of these, yeah, and one of these. As we just went through the story, you know, and just in the writing, I was like, you know what? They wouldn't leave this person behind or this animal behind. They would let them join and come with them or on the journey. Or, you know, this person would be looking for someone to travel with. And so it came very organically.
There is an interesting panel that you did where all the animals were talking about their concept of death and the soul. Was that something philosophically you were always kind of thinking about in your head? And what was the, in writing the book, what were some of the things that maybe you discovered or learned about?
Well, it was from the get-go. You know, all these people asked, well, like, how did the wake happen? And I wanted it to be very clear that's not the point of the story. That's not what we're going to be exploring. It's, you know, when you sit down, you know, when you have to be to work in the morning, or you need to go get your mom from the doctor's office, you need to go pick up the kids after soccer, you're not thinking, like, well, why are we here? How did we get here? How did this all happen? It might keep you up at night, or you might have your personal beliefs, you know, when your mind turns towards it, but you don't get to call out of work with an existential crisis. And so it's that kind of thing that, like, Sandor has a job to do. He needs to take care of Jesse. He needs to get Jesse to her half-brother. And so it was just sort of touching on, like, while it does prey upon their minds, and I did want to address, like, you know, that communal fear, like, where do we go? What is our place? Like, is there a life after this? And if so, do we get to go there? What happens to us? So I wanted to have the moment of slowing down, of showing the animals' fears, that it's not just about, like, you know, just survival, base survival, but that there is a richness and an attention and a knowledge of, if first, what is life and who gets to have it? And if you've even answered that question, then what is death? And who gets to have what comes after that?
It that page, when I got to it, I took a couple minutes to read it over because it was so interesting seeing the different places where people can come to these conclusions. It really got me thinking. So is there an end to the book? Is there a length of how long the book's going to last for?
Oh, I'm afraid you can't expect me to admit to that.
Okay, so it's ongoing for now. All right. Anything that we could look forward to that you're going to be working on?
In 2 weeks, I take over Mighty Morphin Power Rangers from Boom Studios. So that would be the next thing.
Were you a fan of that?
Oh, very much so. And I slept with a hard plastic saber-toothed tiger way longer than was age appropriate.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you being on the show. I hope you have a great rest of the show and get home safely.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed the show. I hope they enjoyed the interviews. Thanks once again to Casey Parsons, Jim Zub, and Marguerite Bennett for being generous with your time while you guys were working at the show. And remember, stay tuned. I got more footage coming your way from Fan Expo Canada. Don't forget to email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on iTunes or follow us on Facebook. Leave a review on iTunes. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and this is the Cave of Solitude.